World, welcome back to the PocketGamer.biz podcast with me, your host Brian Baglow, for our weekly roundup of the movers, the shakers and the great and good of the mobile games world. Joining me this week, we have our editorial team, Craig Chappell, Head of Content, Daniel Griffiths, our editor, and Paige, our deputy editor. Well, let's dive straight in. So, folks, what have you been up to this week?
I'll go first, shall I? It's been a great week, actually, but we're just saying really hectic. This week, you can never predict how it's going to go, but yeah, knee deep in good stuff all week. Main thing for me, I've been keeping an eye on Scopely's Monopoly Go first anniversary, which my life is flashing before my eyes. It's a year already, incredible. So yeah, they've had a fantastic year. No one could have ever predicted how successful that game's going to be, and I love it when a good, well planned and executed success story happens. So. That's been a major point of focus for me. Lots more coming on Monopoly Go on the site pretty shortly. And also the early doors of the alternative app stores on iOS in the EU. More on that later. Suffice to say, it's not going how I want it to go. But
the Apple Defense Force is not happy.
Seriously, I'm as neutral as can be. But you know, come on. We'll talk later. And currently, Aaron, the news head of the team, is currently under lock and key at Stockholm, at the King HQ. So yes, they're keeping a careful eye on him, make sure that he doesn't steal anything or take photographs of anything that he's not supposed to. So yes, we have secret covert chats going on right now. He's trying to get as much out of King as possible. So that's all coming up for the site.
I hope he doesn't look. I hope they don't look at the website. Then he's already taken snaps and put them in an article.
Well, I know. I think whether he's having them censored or not, I don't know. But yeah, I've said if you see any whiteboards. Or anything interesting.
Take a picture.
Yeah. Anything in waste paper baskets to get a picture of.
I had. Sorry to already derail the podcast. I went to. Oh, should I even say this? I went to a studio once. I was going to say it was. And I remember being walked around, and this was before the Xbox One. And it had a code name, Durango. And sure enough, as I walked around, they give me the studio tour. There were some machines that just had Project Durango written on it. I guess that's a thing.
So, amazing! Yeah. Wow, you were there. You were there. So
yeah, Aaron, take but yeah, that's
yeah, that's about it for my week. I was going to be building my Love Island fire pit this weekend. But Travis Perkins aren't delivering the breeze blocks till Monday. So yeah.
Love Island and breeze blocks are not sort of two words that should go together, Daniel.
They'll come together perfectly when it's all finished. So my inaugural Craig David pool party is going to get knocked back a week. But come summer, it'll be ready. I promise.
Still Media Fest.
Podcast by. Yes, podcast by the pool.
Yep,
it has to happen.
I'm working to a deadline.
Thanks so much. Oh, even better. We love deadlines here, especially the whistling noise they make as they go past. Daniel, thank you so much. Paige, let's jump over to you.
Yeah, it's been a good week. It's gone very quick. But yeah, the usual from me, just sort of new features on the site. We had an interview with Kuali that's gone up, but we'll come back to those a little bit later. I won't take too much time now. We'll discuss them shortly. And in other news, like following on from last week, I can't remember if I said I'd watched one episode of the Fallout series or if I'd watched two. Well, now I've watched all of them. So yeah, it's still great. Like, I'm not a massive binge watcher. Usually I'm a two episodes and like, I need a break. But the fact that I've finished it, it kind of speaks volumes. But yeah, it's very good.
It does. I've been kind of saving it. And last night I got to the point where I went, sod it. My partner's not home. I'm watching it anyway. So I've only watched episode one, but loving it. Loving the aesthetic, loving the way they've brought the whole sort of silo to life.
Yeah, it's very well done.
And like most of the rest of the mobile world, it has joyously or joyfully pushed me back to playing Fallout Shelter. I think I've killed half my people in the year and a half. I've not touched it, but I am now very, very definitely back. I'm sitting here with the iPad beside me, folks, just because it's always handy to fill in the 10 to 15 minutes when your, you know, guest hosts don't show up for podcasts and the like.
Yeah, apparently the uptake on Shelter has been, off the back of the TV show, has been remarkable. Something like 400-500% up week on week or something. So, so yeah, everyone's rediscovering Fallout. It's good news.
It's a franchise for a reason. And last but not least, Craig, you've been at your desk all week,
I can't believe it. And next week I'll be at my desk until Dubai Game Expo Summit. It's obviously on May 1st and 2nd, squeeze it in there, but I'll be out there in Dubai.
That's always good to plug. 1st and 2nd.
But
thank you very much.
Other than not travelling, I've been, this week I did a webinar with Raptor PR, also included Quali, Zebedee and Stash. We just talked about Digital Markets Act, and Archie is just Archie from Stash, the biggest expert on the topic that you could find. I came out of it learning a few things as well, so that was really great. Hopefully we'll be able to include a link on this podcast as well, so if people want to check that out. Otherwise, I haven't been watching Fallout, but I watched a Finnish film, keeping up my trend of the last few weeks, talk about Finland, called Sisu. Anyone's ever heard of it? It's like a Finnish John Wick.
I've been meaning to watch it. It's on my list.
It's pretty good, I would say. The main character doesn't really say anything. I don't think he actually utters a single word.
Cool. That's the definition of cool, so that sounds good.
And I watched Bullet Train as well, which is also a Brad Pitt film. It's also fantastic.
It's bonkers. I watched it on a flight to Australia last year, and it was so energising that I had to get up and move around the plane at like 2 a.m. or some godless hour, because it was just too exciting.
It's very fun.
To stay sitting still. But it is. It's fun. It's stupid. It's sort of very manga anime without being in any way manga or anime.
It's and it just turns out like any film set on a train, I think is good now. I think it's Snowpiercer, great film. Train to Busan, also great.
Yeah, and Under Siege 2, my favourite on a train film. Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, okay, I'll check it out. Yeah, it's been way better than Under Siege.
But yeah, was well,
if I can go. Oh. Okay, I feel this may be a different podcast, but I'm going to go early years British, Brief Encounter, which is two people at a train station in the rain waiting for a train and having awful tea. Yeah. But so it's not quite as good, but it...
Other than that, very similar to Under Siege 2.
Yeah. Oh, completely. It's almost identical. But anyway, let's move straight on. I think we're getting into our groove now, which is always good. So the week in headlines, the week in news. Daniel, what have you been seeing? What have you been writing?
Yeah, I got a bunch of stuff down here. Let's get the bad news over with. Just when you thought the layoffs had stopped, they have indeed been diminishing. Quali have been impacted with 10% of their workforce laid off, unfortunately. It's 10% staff or 40 people as part of a restructuring effort to maximise growth opportunities. So yeah, it's part of the ongoing trend. We're hoping that it's you know, we're seeing the end of it by now. The interesting thing with this one is that it seems to have really caught them on the hop, because they've been recruiting. So there's 20 new staff members recently, and job adverts were going up within 24 hours of the rumoured redundancies happening. So there was a senior finance executive role and an API and testing engineer role. These jobs are now no longer accepting applications. So, yeah, quite what's happened there. But you know, it's part of the sudden knee jerk that's happening all over the shop, really. But yeah, so hopefully those folks that are affected can come out the other side of that as quickly as possible, and we see the back of this as soon as we can. Connected with that, the International Games Developer Association pointed out 8,700 people have lost their jobs in 2024 so far, and you know, it's highly commendable, but yeah, they put a statement that basically they want it to stop. They want sustainable measures put in place to stop mass layoffs and stop driving talent away, which is an admirable thing to say and something we all agree with. But you know, quite whether it's going to have an effect, I don't know. They very accurately point out that, and this is a quote. You know, it's a little bit like being told off by your mum, but it's companies must understand that periods of accelerated growth are often followed by natural periods of stagnation or even decline, and that reducing headcounts is a short-sighted financial solution. So there you go. If you've laid anybody off, you're being very naughty and you shouldn't have done that. I know it's not as simple as that, but the IGDA would like to imply that it is. So yeah, it's a bit like being slapped in the face when you've already got bad news on your plate, but yeah, that's the state of play with that.
I've got to add on the Qali stuff, like, not to go into their comms on the layoffs, but I think this is just what's going to happen with hyper casual companies specifically. I know they've diversified. I can't believe I used that word. I know they've diversified away from hyper casual, and they're going hybrids, PC, console. But you know, when Apple just sort of upends your business and keeps gunning for it, and same now with Google to a degree, you know what, it's gonna impact your business. You have to change your structure, I guess, and what teams you have, because that part is no longer as profitable as it used to be, so you have to focus elsewhere. So it's always a shame. I can see why it's happened, and perhaps to a degree they've been kind of forced into that by factors outside of their control. The other hand is, you know, the IDFA kind of happened a long time ago, so you could see, you know, this is coming, but to find an alternative solution takes a long time. That's my thoughts on those, like, specific layoffs, and I don't think they'll be the only hyper casual company to go through that.
Yeah, no, for sure. Twisting around to some good news. I mentioned it earlier on. Monopoly Go's first birthday, and there was a really great video they put up, where they interviewed the team. That was really, really nice, and introduced a lot of folks, some of which we've spoken to extensively for the site, and others we'd like to speak to in the future. It was a really nice little story, I thought, and I wrote a piece for the site about their little behind the scenes insight into the game. 7 years in the making, which is quite hard to take in, but it's highly commendable and admirable in my book that a mobile games company, seemingly with $2 billion in the bank, seemingly fixated on profit, they spent ages working on this thing and perfecting it. So I was that was really, really nice to see. It's worth taking a look. They are, of course, doing a series of events and offers within the game, so we're going to be keeping track on that. What works for them could work for you. So I'm sure there'll be all eyes on what Monopoly Go will be doing for their first anniversary in the coming week or two. Other stuff, I've got to touch on my favorite Apple and Epic. You know, it's very easy to get lost in this mess. But Apple are fighting at tooth and nail against Epic, of course. They're fighting back against they're denying violating the US court order on alternative payments. I think, you know, Apple and Epic need to basically take it into the car park and thrash it out. Tim Sweeney versus Tim Cook, you know, just bare knuckles, knives even. I don't mind. Just settle this so it's gone. In short, Apple's development and implementation of its framework for compliance with the injunction was undertaken in good faith, they say, and they are claiming now that Epic are not just seeking to enforce the injunction, but are looking to micromanage Apple's business operations in a way that would increase Epic's profitability. So yeah, it's never going to stop, is it? And it's messy for devs, messy for users, and frankly annoying for the rest of us. So yeah, rather like the IGDA stating the obvious and wanting everything to calm down. Yeah, I'd like Apple and Epic to just take it outside.
Well, a couple of things. I think, first of all, you should say, as predicted on this podcast several episodes ago, ... because we did say that the Battle of the Timbs was looming. I think in terms of nominative determinism, if the CEOs were called maybe Rick and Dave, we might be more likely to see that knife fight that we all secretly want. But yeah. Tim is a little bit like Brian, you know. You're never going to get a secret agent called Brian, for example. So maybe yeah. Tims are just too nice. Maybe they just need to go for a lovely cuppa and sort it out.
Yeah, we can hope. We live it. We live in hope.
I just want to say that, I guess I can't speak to the. I'm not a lawyer, but when I remember when the kind of case finished and you could link to web payments, and everyone popped the champagne, and then within hours, Apple says, "No, it's 27%. Here's some scarce screens," and then. Now they kind of come back and go, no, but we are obeying the law. And it goes back to, yeah, you're obeying. I guess maybe that was the letter of that law, but was it the spirit of what? Well, it was the law, but was it the spirit of what kind of the judge's ruling was? And I guess that's what that judge is now going to decide. Just endless back and forth.
Yeah, they need beating down, frankly. I think we'll talk about DMA and stores a little bit later on. But other stuff. I was disappointed to see Nintendo are a no-show for Gamescom 2024, which is the kind of thing which is gold for a news site, because you get to speculate away. As to Nintendo are broken and bust, and they can't even afford a stand at Gamescom, you know. But part of me is just quietly sort of smiling and nodding to myself. It's not ready yet. Switch 2 ain't there. They have nothing. There is no point in them rolling out the old stuff, spending millions of euros, having a presence at Gamescom. So I think it's quite cool of them. They're just not bothering this year. If they ain't got nothing to show, they are alive, they are well, they are very rich, they are planning something amazing for 2025, so they're having 2024 off. So yeah, I back them. But Nintendo fans are going to be a bit disappointed that there ain't going to be nothing, but that's the way it goes. I was just going to say, I was there at the launch of the GameCube in Tokyo way back when. And I remember being super excited when they unveiled the GameCube and saying, wow, I can't wait. Where's the Mario and the Zelda game for it? And they wheeled out Luigi's Mansion. So they're avoiding a Luigi's Mansion moment, I think. You know, if they haven't got the big guns and they haven't got it, it's not ready. They're taking their time and they're going to do the job properly.
That's a good game.
So yeah, I'm all for them.
Well, not what everyone wanted. Yeah. That's a good game.
I did really try hard to give it the benefit of my doubt back in the day, but I think it's commendable that if it ain't ready, don't even turn up to the party. So yeah, we'll see you in 2025, Nintendo.
It's well, to go back to the point you were making earlier, Craig, about Project Durango. I joined AMA Design when they were part of the Dream Team for Project Reality, which was the N64. I don't think Nintendo need to prove themselves anymore. And let's be honest, you know, the major summer sort of consumer show or even B2B show for games has kind of seen a lot of consolidation, shall we say, with the loss of E3. And I think there's going to be more of that, because it's like the old model of buyers going in and buying product in time for Christmas just doesn't exist anymore. You know, so a different format, a different sort of way of showcasing, highlighting, celebrating, getting people excited about your games, I think will come. And maybe that in itself is something we'll see in 2025, which is a whole new format of game shows.
Well, I think Nintendo's already, well, at least with E3, so it's a bit, it is different, but with E3, they pulled out a long time ago, and then they just do the Nintendo Directs as their core way to get to their audience. I don't think this is necessarily related to that. I think Daniel's right. They just skip a year. They've got nothing really to say. And that might end up just looking worse if they go, right? And then when they launch the Switch 2, I'm sure they'll be back out there in full force.
Well, I think we can all be absolutely certain that they are going to be back. But as usual, this is Nintendo. It's going to be on their terms. And it may well take the rest of the industry by surprise. Well, fingers crossed. Paige, over to you.
Yeah, so moving on to more featurey and interviewee type bits. We had a feature on the site that was sort of exploring the state of play for the 4X strategy genre. And it kind of goes into, you know, some of the big games within that subgenre and sort of taking a closer look at, you know, how and why they've been as successful as they have been. It was interesting that, like, some of the data in there, so I think it was 6 of the top 50 games are 4X strategies, and then the part I found interesting was that all of the other strategy genres make less than a third of what 4X strategy does alone. Like, that took me by surprise, but yeah, just interesting sort of, you know, how huge essentially this subgenre is in terms of its revenue. And another thing that I thought was interesting was that it seems to be a lot of Asian developers that are, you know, particularly successful with using this genre as opposed to, say, Western developers. And I'm not fully sure why that is, if you guys know, but like the piece kind of states that, like, maybe they're a bit less sort of afraid of the failure of it.
I don't know why, but it could be like just aggressive monetization, and maybe they're more comfortable with that. They've built up the expertise there. But, you know, it has been like, but it's not just Asian companies. Like, historically, Machine Zone did very much, made billions of dollars. Again, it does come back to the question, how profitable was that? But legitimately, they spent a lot on UA. So it's not always from there, but it's a genre that's been around for a long time, making a lot of money. Interesting to see how it's evolved somewhat, and there's some sort of newer takes on it now where you're combining sort of other gameplay elements, and then you add on to that a broader 4X strategy design. I can't remember what it's called. Puzzles and Zombies or something. I can't remember what it's called. I think it's 37 Games. I think they do that, so it's like sort of match-free RPG, and then they combine it with 4X strategy elements. So yeah, the way it's evolved is really interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting piece. Yeah, some of the data in there was definitely like a little bit of a surprise to me anyway. Another feature piece we had was from Integral's Jeff Hsu. This was on sort of looking at the options for demand platforms. And it was an interesting piece in the sense that he sort of had a very concise idea, and he offered these three options. So one was on ad exchanges, one's working with SDK-less mediation platforms, and the other's sort of building your own SDK and sort of integrating it with supply partners. And then he kind of goes through each of those three options, gives you the advantages of it and the drawbacks of each one. So, you know, for example, like he kind of said, so with ad exchanges, you've got the possibility of being up and running pretty quick with like minimal effort needed. But on the flip side of that, it then comes at a higher cost. And he was sort of saying that the pricing for that can also be, you know, it's not necessarily the most transparent route. So so he kind of does that for each of those three points and shares insight to each of the options. And then it's just one of those pieces that's quite nice, neutral and fair. It gives you all these options and weighs them all up and then lets you kind of be like, right, which is the one that could work best for me.
Yeah, I love features like this where you know, when you go into them and all you want is an answer, you know, you find yourself, your case within the feature and say, oh, well, I'm that. And this is what an expert says that I should be doing this, removing the randomness and the, you know, everyone's got an opinion. But yeah, it's nice when an expert says, look, you know, these are your options in plain English. So yeah, hopefully folks find that useful.
We'll have to get back to them and say that it's not how you do Google SEO these days. It's got to be a 2,000-word article that doesn't answer any of your questions until the 1900th word.
It's true. I've been watching loads of YouTube recently, and the amount of videos where they explain why they're going to tell you the answer to the question for half an hour, and it's like, mate, this is killing me. So yeah, it happens. There's a lot of it out there, but it's not in this feature. It gets to the point. It's a good one.
Yeah. And then a final bit from me out of sort of features and into interviews. Obviously, we've mentioned Qualy earlier in terms of sort of layoffs, but I did do an interview with Qualy, but this was sort of before the layoffs. But I had a chat with their publishing manager, Saeed Rahman. We met back at PGC London, so we met in person there. And he was just a really nice guy. And he's one of those people who, when you sort of chat to him, you can really tell that he genuinely really loves the gaming industry. Like, he was really enthusiastic and yeah, really nice to talk to. So we sort of followed up from that and had another chat. And yeah, in the interview, he sort of explains, you know, his beginnings in the industry, how he ends up at Qualy. And then, you know, I'm always interested in the publishing side of things, in the sense of, you know, how do you pick the games and the developers that you want to work with? Like, how much of it is just numbers and metrics and on paper, this looks great, let's go with it? And how much of it is, nope, this just sounds like a brilliant game and you seem like a good fit for us, so let's roll with that. So we sort of touched on that and what Qualy's approach is, and obviously they can't completely ignore metrics, but for them, you know, there are obviously other factors. So yeah, we kind of go into that, and yeah, we touched on like loads of bits, really, sort of, you know, the challenges in the gaming industry at the moment, to what big trends there are, anything that, you know, he was particularly excited about. And also, obviously, this month on the site, we've sort of been highlighting the MENA region a lot. So it was interesting to hear from him that Qualy are also, you know, very focused this year on looking towards the MENA region and looking to expand there and, you know, just pursue new partnerships. So yeah, it was a good chat with just a very nice person.
Which we love. And hearing from publishers about the other 50% of the market is always a joy. I think we tend to focus on developers, and the industry is so about the new games and it's who's making the games. So we get developer. So it's like the role of the publisher is sometimes undervalued. And the fact that in mobile, they do so much. It's not just manufacturing and distribution and marketing, which it was way back in the olden days, but it's the analytics, it's community management, potentially monetization, lifetime value, all the other, you know, side of things that we can sometimes ignore, or at least not be as interested in. So that it was a brilliant piece, Paige. Really enjoyed it. So thank you very much indeed. And finally, Craig, how about yourself? What were your standouts for the week?
So another Apple bit of news. What we're talking about, it's not
you
another
never
Apple
have
bit
enough.
Of news. It's a Google bit of news. It's like the other side of Epic's fight. So Epic Games has submitted an injunction proposing significant changes to Google Play to Google Play's App Store policies following its antitrust win over the company in December. A jury in the US found that Google held an illegal monopoly over Android app distribution and in-app billing. So just in itself, it's kind of amazing that Apple is not guilty. Google is, whereas Google runs an open Android ecosystem. But alas, yeah, they were found to be holding an illegal monopoly. So the court requested Epic submit a proposed injunction of changes that that Google should make, and it's now submitted those. So it called for Google to allow consumers to download apps from wherever they choose without interference or, as we said earlier, scare screens. It also said developers must be allowed to offer alternative payment options without Google imposing anti-competitive fees, and that companies should be able to communicate directly with consumers, including links to external web stores. Epic's also proposed that Google cannot retaliate against it from challenging its App Store practices and nor impede the launch of the Epic Games Store. So Epic continues to, as some might say, fight the good fight. And it's kind of, I wanted to kind of allude, say earlier, you know, part of Apple's case was that Epic wants to increase its own profitability. Well, yeah, obviously. Like, that is one of its reasons for being, and that's why Apple then defends itself, because it wants to keep being profitable. But I think you could easily, but part of that case, you argue, all right, well, if you make Epic more profitable from this, then that would make everyone else more profitable, probably. So, yeah, another one to keep watching. But I guess that case technically already been decided, but exactly how, what that then looks like for Google, one to follow.
It is an interesting one. It's an interesting one. Trying to find any kind of sympathy for the tech giants that are out there on all sides is kind of increasingly hard. Because, yes, they're all fighting their corner. They all want to sort of improve profitability. Their shareholders would be quite cross if not. But at the weekend, I went and picked up a new book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Check this for a doorstep. So I'm about a third of the way in.
It's a massive, and massive book.
Yeah, I could kill a horse with this book, and not by feeding it to it. You could beat a crocodile to death. It's a bit of a chunk. I'll share a link. It's when we put this out. But it's essentially looking at the era of big data and the era of how technology, you know, all pulls together. All the tech giants are kind of complicit in different ways, but they're all at it. So I might be in a cynical phase right now, but I'm like, yeah, it's, remember the days where you had good old fashioned cottage industries and little developers just making good games, which isn't like me. So I'll wait to see what the outcome of that is, because I would love Google to go back to their not being evil, but I think those days are long gone.
So elsewhere, another financial story at an odd time. I don't understand how they do their quarters here. It was like the quarter ended in February. So, okay. So MAG Interactive revenue fell by 25% year over year as it places a big bet on a new crossword game called Crozzle. So MAG Interactive's revenue fell to about $6.5 million in Q2. And it reported, technically, it reported a loss of about $174,000. But adjusted EBITDA, so usually I think I'm wrong with financials, so I say this is made up, but I think people actually use non-GAAP as how the business is actually doing. But anyway, the adjusted EBITDA was, they made 1.8 million. So there's like a massive disparity there. But apparently that's because they tried to claim for research and development deductions over the last few years, and that has actually been rejected. So they were suddenly lumped with a tax bill of about 1.5 million plus an additional bit of interest that they just decided to pay off. They're still fighting it. and they believed that they should get those deductions. But I thought that was a unique and interesting story from the week. But otherwise, I think outside of that, they probably would have been, well, it sounds like they would have been profitable despite revenue declining. But they're also placing a big bet on their new game. Crozzle is in soft launch, crossword game. We'll see how it does. They said so far it's hitting kind of targets. But hopefully for them that starts to do well, reaches a global launch in the next few months. That's their target. Elsewhere, we've got, I think both of these are in Sweden. Polytopia dev Midjuan has opened Game Town, a co-working space for Swedish indies. So it will become Midjuan, who make the Battle of Polytopia. That will be their new home, but they're also going to have a few other kind of startups or just small indie studios with them there. And other developers are also still applying, so it sounds like it's a pretty big space. They hope that GameTel becomes a creative, innovative, and social meeting place for the local Swedish industry. So they'll host mixes, game showcases, networking events. The thing that fascinated me, as I know Sweden is a cool games industry hub, but I cannot pronounce this. I apologize to everyone. It's probably easy, but Södermalm, hopefully that's how you pronounce it. An island.
Flawless, Craig. Flawless.
An island in Stockholm. That is home to Paradox, DICE, Fat Shark, Star Stable, Avalanche Studios, Epic Games, and loads of others. And it's just a really small area that they all these really massive studios are located in. So, yeah, I just can't believe that. That'll be the next tour we do after Finland. We'll now be going to this island in Stockholm. And then kind of sticking with kind of the region, we had a story this week, so we updated Soft Launch, and Moomin Puzzle and Design has been in there since, well, for years, 2 years at least, and that's now been cancelled. So it didn't meet expectations, and they've decided to get rid of it. I think part of it is because I think it's probably because of the Sega acquisition, and now they've just got other IP to work with. That game just never really took off. And I think while it's popular in certain countries like Finland and Japan, I think specifically, might be popular elsewhere. I'm not that familiar with Moomin, sorry. But maybe it's a bit too niche and just not what they're after. So kind of a shame, especially for something that's been in soft launch for so long. But yeah, Rovio has eyes on other
things. Yeah. It's an odd one because it's simultaneously a global brand, but it's quite niche. You know, it has a very dedicated following in a lot of places. You know, you go into certain very twee craft shops and you can buy Moomin tea towels and candles and all sorts. In every country I've ever been to, you can find Moomin stuff, but I don't know who it's for. So, yeah. I can see that might be why it's taken a couple of years. They know there's people out there. They can see the sales of the merchandise, but maybe, you know, a puzzle game just wasn't quite the vehicle for them.
Yeah. Moomins are an odd one for me. When I was a kid, they were old-fashioned. They were too old, and I wasn't interested at all. It was kid stuff because, you know, they've been around since the 40s or whatever. So it was, you know, yeah, like. Yeah, the stench of death and age about them. So yeah, it was they were odd to me. And
well, yet, there you go.
And then when the Moomin sort of popped up again, then I was too old. Then I was genuinely kind of like, oh, Moomin to back, are they? But yeah, so I don't think there's a sufficiently large demographic all hitting mobile app stores all at once that go, yay, Moomins. So yeah, they've been around for a long time, but. You know, yeah, the Moomin audience is very fragmented, as I would say, but yeah.
If only the world's largest mobile games companies came and spoke to the Pocket Gamer team before they invested 2 years in a soft launch, or just listen to the podcast.
Yeah, thumbs up or thumbs down, that kind of thing. Yeah, we'll just tell it like it is. Yeah, here to help.
I would say as well, like as Rovio will know, the puzzle space isn't exactly short of competition, especially in the match and blast space. So, yeah, maybe they also decided the environment wasn't right for that particular game. And then lastly, just as a very quick update, so we've updated the soft launch yet again. I seem to be addicted to updating it at the moment. But there's new games, so from KEK Entertainment, which I think raised about $8 million. They've released Armor Attack, which I think they're former War Robots developers, and it's kind of in the vein of that. Steer Studios, which is the in-house development team at Savvy Gaming, or Savvy Games Group, has released Grunt Rush. And then Wildlife has soft-launched Greedy Wizards. Lightnear, Finnish studio, soft-launched Rumble Arena. And River Game has got a Final War. They've already made like $1 billion from, I want to say, Top War. So, yeah, some exciting games to look out for there.
Great stuff. And as always, we'll be sharing the link to the soft launch piece in the show notes. Thank you so much, folks. So we're going to keep things moving and come round to the Week in Views section. Daniel, I believe we're back at you first.
Yeah. My pick of the week. I'll keep it short. I touched upon it earlier on. First dawnings of alternative app stores on iOS, and it's a confusing mess. Unfortunately, you know, is this what we wanted? Probably not. Is this what we should have all expected? Yes, certainly. So, Alt Store is a it's an open source app store, and it's made specifically for independent developers. And in their notes, they proudly say, if you've ever experienced issues with app review, then this is the store for you. And they proudly say that if your app has been rejected, or if you've ever been told that your app wasn't good enough, then this is the store that wants your game. It's a very intriguing offer. I just wish that the doors had finally opened and the first app store through the door had been something that we can all get on board with, we can all understand, has good stuff in it, and makes sense to the majority of users. But no, it's hard to say whether Apple are going to be delighted by the slightly shambolic nature of this first app store, or whether they're going to be appalled, as they always threatened that they would be. Alt Store contains the first thing through the gate is, of course, a Nintendo emulator called Delta, being the reason that the creator of Alt Store created the app in the first place, he says. And then the other thing that's in the store at the minute is Clip, a clipboard manager that he proudly boasts can actually run in the background. So there you go. So your first dip into this thing is to find a thing called Alt Store. And then there is Nintendo emulator and a clipboard app in there. And you pay for it by taking a subscription. The one app is free, the other is €1. But the App Store, you subscribe to it for €1.5 a year, which covers Apple's core technology fee. And they reckon that once they've, now that it's out there, they want your app on board. I worry that it's just all too confusing. The Alt Store's design is, of course, it's completely decentralized. So there's no central directory of apps, much as users might want it to make sense. Basically, apps can come and go. You can put it on there. You can take it off there. You know, yay. It just sounds like a nightmare. But, you know, as I say, whether the big picture, whether Apple are looking at it going, brilliant, this looks like a confusing shambles, like we always knew it would, with any luck, this is going to die a death. Or whether they are in tears, wringing their hands, saying, look at this awful mess. And like I say, the first thing through the gate is a potentially, in quotes, allegedly illegal emulator of Nintendo games. So it's everyone's worst nightmare come true, and yet it should be exactly what we expected. I think there will be some great app stores, and there will be some great new products in there. I think devs and publishers getting paid the money that they deserve for their product is and they're being choice and different routes to market and different choices for consumers. I think it's all brilliant, but I want somebody to do it in a nice, non-snarky, weird, easy to understand way, and we're not there yet. So yeah, that's how it is. Oh, and yeah, and apps are paid for with Patreon donations. So yeah, could it get weirder? No, it couldn't. So yeah, hopefully the good app store will be along any minute.
At least it's not crypto.
It's everything but, frankly.
Yeah. Maybe they're leaving that for Q3. That's an unusual move. You'd think since 2008, people would have been able to sort of see how to run an app store, or even how not to run an app store, and come out with something that is maybe a little more feature complete. That seems very odd.
They're literally embracing, Apple did it like this, so we're going to do everything differently and stick it to the man because we're allowed to. And it's like kind of like, yeah, I know you can do that, but you know the user just wants it easy. So just have some nice apps and let us buy them. This notion of free games, but you've got to subscribe to have the store.
I've got two things on this.
It's deep.
Which is like stores like this, or well, not to criticize this particular, but like stores that come out if they have issues or legal issues, like it shouldn't be Apple's job to police the internet. They shouldn't be allowed to do that, and Apple shouldn't have to do that either. And so I think just let these things happen. Like, I have a PC with Windows. Like, Microsoft isn't policing the internet there, so why should they do it on an iPhone? This is my whole thing with Apple. It's like, oh, but the privacy and security of the beloved iOS ecosystem. It's like, well, do you know what? I have a Windows PC, functions perfectly well. Like, it's not riddled with viruses.
I absolutely agree. I'm all for something new and good coming along, and everyone getting paid properly. But it's like kind of like this ain't it. So yeah, it's there, and you can have it if you want it. But you know, it's not doing this opportunity good service.
And I'll say, but my second issue though is that I think Apple will start getting in trouble if, again, not a lawyer, who knows? But they'll start getting in trouble if companies have to then pass on the core technology fee to their users, which I guess they do. So if you've got an app like this, or a store like this, that's like, oh, we're going to charge this. Like, I don't think, surely that won't fly with like the EU.
Yeah, the slightly terrifying thing with this, you know, I think it's a two-man band that have put this alt store together. They're paying 50 cents for every download. They are paying that. So yeah, they've just signed on the line for, you know, if millions of people are trying this, just to try for 5 minutes and get confused and annoyed by it, then they're on the hook for a lot of money. Hence the subscription. I did see in the chat and in loads of people can't make it work and have paid and have got nothing and aren't happy with it. I'm sure it's early teething, but you know this is the mess that it's currently in. So yeah, hopefully one day soon it'll all make sense and be nice and better and open and fair. But this is the first bite of the cherry.
It's, well, we wish them Godspeed. Maybe they're seeing something that we, the mobile professionals, are not. But rest assured that whatever happens, you'll hear about it first on pocketgamer.biz. Paige, let's come to you next.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to Fallout for my week in views. Obviously, I was chatting about it earlier. And I think, you know, Daniel, I think you briefly mentioned that we'd done a story on it this week in terms of the fact that because of the series coming out, the game, you know, Fallout Shelter has had, I think it was like 516% like boost in downloads, which is just, it's just crazy. I think like you know, I guess we could have kind of predicted that, you know, show comes out, of course, the other things are gonna get a boost from that. I don't feel like if the show was a flop, you probably wouldn't get quite the same impact. No one's gonna want to jump back into a game because of a terrible TV show. But luckily it's very good. And it's just funny because I was literally talking yesterday about, you know, how many video game adaptations we're getting at the moment, whether it's, you know, TV series, movies, animated stuff, you know, they're just sort of coming thick and fast at this point. And yeah, I think it's a smart move because they just have this ready made fan base. Like, you know, there's already millions of people that love Fallout. So if you make a Fallout show, and especially if you make a good Fallout show, you've got just a guaranteed audience of people that are going to lap it up. And it's also quite interesting to see that it's not just the fans and even people that are sort of considered, and I say in quotes, non-gamers, that are also now like, oh well, I've really enjoyed this series, so I want to play more of it. Like, I cannot tell you, I would have never ever in my entire life bet that my mum would download any kind of Fallout game, but she's downloaded Fallout Shelter. So just, yeah, bit mind-blowing for me.
Yeah, the look of it, I mean, I'm sort of, you're very familiar with the look and the feel of the games, but yeah, the look of the TV show, yeah, it really made my eyes pop, sort of seeing it in sort of live action. So you've got to think about the folks that haven't even heard of Fallout. It's got such a weird look to it.
I think that's part of the appeal.
They're going to go, there's a game? Okay, let me see this game. So yeah, I think it's not just fans of the game watching the TV show. I think it's going to be more TV show watchers discovering the game. So yeah, it works out perfect.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously they rope things in. So like, I think if it's in Fallout Shelter, it's like, oh well, you can get, you know, the character Lucy or the character the Ghoul. You can have them in your shelter, and people instantly felt it's a little bit of like fear of missing out, like, oh, if I don't play it now, I'm not going to get these characters that I really love from the show. So it's just really sort of clever. Like I said, it's not necessarily a surprising story, it's just clever. And because their daily revenue, I think that was like a 384% boost in Fallout Shelter, and that's something like 200,000 over 5 days. So it's just crazy. And you know, it's not just Fallout Shelter, you know, you've got people picking up Fallout 3, New Vegas, Fallout 4 again, and you know, you can kind of pick those up for probably dirt cheap now. But yeah, it is just this sort of double-edged sword of, you know, have a good game, make it into a good series, double-edged sword. Or it even kind of works the other way around now, you know, you've got big IPs being like, you know, we want a video game of this now. So yeah, I just think it's very interesting. I'm sure the numbers will settle since you can just binge all of the series, and in a couple of weeks no one will be talking about it, but inevitably there'll be a season two, and I'm sure there'll be peaks again, maybe not quite as high, but there'll definitely be something.
Yeah, I remember when game spin-offs were all crap and now they're all brilliant, you know. What happened? I've no idea.
Hold on, let's not get carried away.
We've got an original Mario Brothers movie fan here, haven't we?
Oh yes.
Exactly. Oh, yes.
It's misunderstood.
Christian Slater's Alone in the Dark, you know, this is what I'm talking about, you know. But yeah, what happened?
If we're just going to pull out the classics, then fine. But I offer as a counterpoint to that, The Last of Us on HBO.
Yeah.
You know, I think the point is that games are now being taken seriously as intellectual property in their own right, and can be used as a basis for movies or TV shows in a way that we've never really seen very often in the past. Because, you know, if anyone ever watched the Doom movie, there is a way of taking a barrel-chested space marine blowing shit up and making it boring. so, you know, games are getting a level of respect now. And for me, Paige, Fallout Shelter is a brilliant abstraction. It keeps the aesthetic. It takes all of the kind of the Pip-Boy, you know, look and feel that you see in the posters and on the bobbleheads and everything, and puts it in a video game. And it's a lovely little, you know, look after your own community. So it's not competitive as such. Yeah. You know, you're looking after the Deathclaws and the Raiders, not looking after, taking care of, in a blowing stuff up kind of way. So yeah, I'm not surprised your mum's downloaded it. It's the sort of thing that people would go, oh, actually, you know, I've quite enjoyed this. And on the aesthetic, Daniel, I'm with you. It's almost hyper real. It's got a very retro futuristic feel, but whatever they've done to treat it, there are points where it looks like it's CGI, but it's not. But it catches you on that very edge of uncanny valley. So I'm sure it's deliberate, but I don't know how they've done it, but it is just beautifully done. And I'm only one episode in, so we're not into the wasteland quite yet, you know, properly. So I don't know if it changes into the, more of the, you know, the Mad Max aesthetic that we know and love. But it's an incredible game. And, you know, to see games that are 5, 10, in some cases 12 years old, get a whole renaissance thanks to a well-made TV show is an absolute joy. And I think it speaks to the ongoing influence of games in the wider creative world.
It's kind of obvious maybe now, but like I think because the world in, say, comic book adaptations is running a bit dry, and you've got entertainment companies looking for big IP to turn into TV shows or film, games is seemingly becoming like the maybe like a natural thing to look at. They've already got built in large audiences. A lot of the ones that have been adapted have got either really deep stories or just deep lore or really fleshed out worlds that you can kind of delve into. So there's a lot to pick out from there. And given that they're kind of relatively untapped in say the film and TV space, I think there's a lot of room for that to happen. It's not always successful. Obviously we use the older examples, but like even more recent times, Assassin's Creed, apparently that wasn't that great. Mm-hmm. I watched the Uncharted film. I didn't really think it was that great either.
It wasn't called Uncharted. It's one of those movies where if you had just called it like Tom Holland Goes on a Treasure Hunt, people probably would have liked it. But because it was Uncharted and you were like, no, Sully doesn't have a mustache, gamers are angry everywhere.
I just didn't think it was
Why do they mess with it?
It could have been any film we could have been. If it was released on Netflix only and called something else, I'd have probably understood. Because when it's like, that's my opinion of not a lot of Netflix movies. They're like, that was all right.
Now you see, it's absolutely interesting. I have a talk that I give, which is looking at how gamers, how players feel far more invested and vocal about their participation in a game and their reaction to a game. Can be quite extreme. So nobody liked Uncharted, nobody liked the end of Game of Thrones, nobody liked the end of Mass Effect, but only one of those was subject to a petition which caused the developer to change the ending. And I think there's a whole other podcast there about the reaction of gamers and the reaction of the industry to gamers when they decide that something's not good enough. It's a really interesting difference because, nobody liked the Uncharted, or few people, let's say. But nobody was out demanding it was refilmed.
Release the Snyder Cut.
I'm not sure what... Go for it, Craig. If only they had turned it into a game where you could make the ending by yourself.
Yeah. 4:3 ratio in black and white. Yeah, go for it.
I'm sure the fan remake can only be a mere weeks or months away.
I think if they'd only released a 2-hour extra cut, a long cut of Uncharted, then...
That's what we want.
In high dynamic resolution black and white.
Yeah.
It could have made all the difference.
Off topic, really quickly.
Go for
Does
it,
anyone
Craig.
Watch Rebel Moon?
Yes! Yes.
I think it's one of the worst films I've ever seen. And I love sci-fi. I'm an easy target. Terrible. And to make it slightly irrelevant, not to games, was that it was told, I'm sure it came out that like they might release like an extra long edit of the first half of the first film of like 2 hours. And I'm like, why? What? It's what a waste of money.
Heartless, heartless, cynical, poorly put together, awful writing, literally no heart in the whole thing. I try very hard not to be overly critical or too judgy, but I actually feel that I want to send in an invoice for my time back for watching that. And they're working on a part two.
It's out, I think.
Dear God.
It's out today? God. Maybe.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's already.
Oh well, guess what we're doing. Guess what we're doing after the podcast, listeners.
Just so I can moan about it.
Next week, Pocket Gamer, the weekend views, Rebel Moon 2. It's like the special. We'll make it 2.5 hours long as well.
Let's do it. We'll release an extra long.
It can be like the Top of the Pops podcast you pointed me towards, Daniel, which I may never forgive you for.
Are you listening to that?
In small increments. There's only so many hours of middle-aged white guys moaning about pop culture that I can put up with. But yeah, it's for long car journeys when I'm stuck on the Edinburgh City bypass for more than 45 minutes. That tends to be one that I gravitate towards. So, good. Thank you. But anyway.
Not safe for the schoolroom.
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, can you imagine? No. Anyway, right, we are going woefully off topic. I'm going to drag this back kicking and screaming. Craig, you've been looking at the current skills crisis in the game sector, I believe.
Yeah, a more serious topic. So a new report has called for the formation of a UK games industry-led body to tackle what it calls a skills crisis in the sector. So this was a report published by Skillful, which was written by Gina Jackson, who's the founder of Skillful, and has been around in the industry for a while. It brought together representatives from 65 game sector employers, and that included Sony, EA, Ubisoft, Sumo, Playground, Sharkbob, Us2, and more, to discuss kind of key recruitment and personnel challenges. Also had support from organisations like British Film Institute, Games London and Yuki, to kind of canvassing their input. So it had a lot of people behind it. And when I say those employers, like, those were kind of varying sizes, right? So it was large, medium and small. So it's not like they've just gone to the largest employers and go, what's your issue? This actually started as kind of research for something else and has evolved into this kind of call for a new body. So the recommendation is the establishment of that body to spearhead the creation of solutions to national skills problems, kind of focusing specifically on the games industry, and to work with employers, policymakers, local and national government, educational institutions, and other key stakeholders to enact them. The research, or the report itself, identified kind of numerous issues and challenges, including like the lack of data on those skills shortages. It noted that only 7% of vacant roles were open for new entrants, which it said risks creating, to quote, creating a stunted pipeline of skilled workers, which could hinder future growth. And it was also took issue with this kind of a lack of, or a shortage of, skilled mid to senior level employees, leading to unfilled roles. So we did an article last year, because there was a Tiger report that said kind of the skills shortage thing as well. And even despite these widespread layoffs, which affect everyone, there are still these vacancies that can't be filled. There could be various reasons for that, but one of them is there's just a shortage of really super experienced talent that studios want. I've been writing about this, to be honest, this kind of, or elements of this, for many years. I used to work on Develop magazine, and the cover we had once was about graduates leaving university and to kind of find that in games there's not that many jobs for them. So I think there's possibly an issue with maybe being kind of overpromised your career prospects. And maybe certain courses, this is a very wide statement, like the blanket statement, there are many courses that are fantastic, but maybe some don't provide the necessary kind of skills that you actually need to get off the ground and kind of started straight away. So I think for juniors, there's long been an issue, and it sounds like for quite a while now, for seniors, it's long been an issue. One of the concerns the report also brought up was that we're now kind of getting the UK games industry, I guess, was kind of one of the first, and a lot of famous Eugene Evans, we'll talk about that, Daniel, and previously, different topic, trying to think, John Hare, the Oliver Twins, etc., etc. And some of those, not necessarily those guys, but some people from like the first generation are now kind of reaching retirement age. They might leave the industry, so you lose some of that experience. And I think maybe a concern is who replaces these experienced developers when they're gone. And if you're struggling to bring in new, not sure this is what the report precisely says, just me now. But if you're struggling to bring in juniors, and you've already got a shortage of senior developers, and Colin McDonald's, what does he work? Games Jobs Live, that was it.
Games Jobs Live, yes.
He was saying, you know, some people have left because, well, various reasons, but one he highlighted when we spoke last year was that maybe they're just a bit sick of being laid off one too many times, because it seems to be not just now, like for decades, maybe, right? Like, studios lay off staff quite a lot. Not to the degree now. But you kind of get sick of that after a while, and maybe there's, like, other potentially better-paid jobs, safer jobs that people go to. So there's quite a few issues that the UK games industry specifically is facing, and this isn't just for this year, but over quite a lot of years now. Like, obviously, other countries have kind of got the same level of government support that we have. They've built up their ecosystems. Some have maybe even kind of surpassed the UK, right? And so there's a lot of challenges to, I think, retain talent, develop talent, and just make sure we actually have an industry that is, I guess, sustainable for the coming years and decades.
So I'm going to jump in on this if you don't mind. This is a huge issue, and I know most of the people involved with this. I've known Gina for years, and she and I both worked at Creative Skillset, which was the charity in the UK that supported skills and training in the creative industries. And the games sector was very much the awkward cousin, you know. So the film screen industries all pay into a levy, which means that they can access discounted rates to train and develop their staff, and also access all of these incredible graduates and create work placements and so on and so forth from all the film schools and schools of art and that kind of thing. Games doesn't do that. You know, if you've ever been in a games company, the chances are you want to change your role, you move up to a senior role, you're either learning on the job or you're pointed at YouTube or, you know, the in-house library and wish the very best of luck. As a sector, and I'm talking about the UK here at the moment, is we're not great at developing our people. So you come in at an entry-level role and, you know, you could start as a QA engineer and end up as a producer, but there's no recognised route. There's no recognised definition of what a producer is. So there's all of these fractures, all of these problems all the way through. And I can tell you from my own experience that the colleges and universities that are producing graduates and people with qualifications rarely, if ever, get those students to look at the companies out there, the potential employers, the games they produce, the platforms they produce work for or publish on, and the tools that they use. So people are coming out perhaps expecting to walk straight into a job at a Rockstar or a Activision Blizzard or indeed a King. And finding out that actually all of the studios around about are doing tiny little indie games on itch, or, you know, just doing match three games on Steam or whatever it happens to be. So at every point we have problems. The colleges don't talk to the universities don't talk to the employers, the industry people don't talk to the universities. Nobody's happy. And then even if you do get a job in the industry, as you've just said so eloquently, Craig, your opportunities for advancement are slim. you know, my last in-house role, I ran a games team, and my artist and animator, who was not 30 at that point, had 5 redundancies under her belt from game studios. So we are facing some problems. And to bring it right back to basics, we are very good in the UK at teaching the design, development and production skills to make a thing. Nowhere in the UK that I've been able to find teaches you how to publish that thing, right? There's nobody out there that's teaching you how to, you know, market your product, acquire users, determine what your business model is. Go into any university in the country or any sort of small indie studio and say, who's responsible for deciding how this game makes money? And they'll all look at each other in some sort of Mexican standoff. So we're not teaching the business side of games. And weirdly, there's almost a disdain in some areas of the games industry when it comes to the business of making games. And if you're not making money from your games, at some point you're going to have to stop and go and get a different job. And I give this talk all the time. And it's like, you don't ever have to ask your player to put their hand in their pocket. You can go down the ad-funded route. You can do rewarded surveys. You can do playable ads. There's so many options, more options than ever. And what that means is it makes your business side of things a design and development choice. So you get to choose how your game makes money. It's not imposed upon you anymore. But we're missing all of that. And to me, it's complete madness. So I'm absolutely delighted. I think Gina has been fighting this fight for well over a decade now, and hopefully this is something that really will open a lot of people's eyes. I think there's an appetite in the UK now to sort of do more with games and support games better, because we don't get the support the tech world gets. We kind of can tap into bits of the screen industries, and the creative industries are, everyone knows they're big, but nobody quite knows what to do with them. So, you know, I think games needs far, far more recognition and support, and I think this is a really big step in the right direction. Right, I'm stepping off my soapbox now. Apologies.
That was really interesting.
That was very nicely put. I agree. That was some succinct points well made, I think. Yeah, things need to change a bit.
Just to quickly add that one of the key points that I think I said was late, that you touched on there, Brian, is just the development of talent. So even mid to senior level, there was an issue where like a lot of government support, say, goes into juniors getting jobs, but they only represented 7% of vacancies. Okay, behind that, the issue is, well, that's not enough vacancies for juniors. but there's then no support for mid-senior level, because I guess when you're an adult, you're just kind of expected, or rather experienced professional, you're kind of expected to just learn, I think, these things yourself, and you should get the experience on the job. But actually, this is calling for, I can't remember the exact term, but just some sort of support for your personal professional development during those times. So we get those experiences.
So many other sectors, so many other sectors, Craig, have a reliance and insistence upon CPD, continuing personal development. If you join any of the big chartered institutes out there, chartered Institute of Marketing or the British Computer Society, or the Chartered Institute of Personal Development, the CIPD, most of their events, if you go to them, it gives you hours. It counts towards your training for the year or for the quarter. I went to an event recently from a computer trade organisation here in Scotland, and they went, you get 8 hours towards your CPD total. And I went, that's amazing. Why don't we go to so many events? Why don't the games world do that? Turns out the games world have never gone and spoken to the CIPD. It's where we don't recognise that personal development is a thing, and that going to conferences to actually learn things can be valuable beyond the it's lovely to see everyone, let's have drinks. So there's more that we could be doing. And as Steel Media, there's more that we could be doing. We do some phenomenal things at our events. You can learn so much in such a short space of time. So maybe there's a conversation we could be having internally or with Skillful to help build that into everything that we're doing, so that we're helping the sector that we love.
Yeah, for sure. Obviously, we had Games Factory Talents for in London for the Career Zone, but there's always more we can do. And I think this report highlights, I think, for everyone in the industry, like, okay, well, what else can we do? Or if we're not doing anything, what can we do? to support people in their careers?
Well, sadly, as much as you can sense that I'm desperate to get into it in a, on an even deeper level, I'm going to bring it to a call, bring it to a halt, I beg your pardon. It's an hour and 15 in, and we've had some great discussion, some really, really good headlines, some really good topics this week. So thank you all for coming along and joining us. Folks, thank you for listening. We really appreciate your time. We know it's a commitment, but hopefully this is something you get a lot out of on a weekly basis, and it helps summarise all of the content that's coming out of the PG.biz network. So thanks for joining us. You'll be hearing from us again next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch, reach out to us. Our email address, we are told, is podcast@pocketgamer.biz, or you can find us on social media, pg.biz, or just search for Pocket Gamer. We look forward to joining you again in the next couple of weeks, and look out for the main podcast where Peggy and I talk in depth to some of the people that we've been mentioning in these very headlines. So until next time, thanks, team. Thanks for joining us. As always, it's been fantastic.